Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, September 9th. I'm Ray Graff. Meteorologist Jason Goff joins us today on the line to answer your questions. Formerly of News Channel 13 in Albany, Jason now runs a forecasting website at jasonsweather.com. You got a question about the late summer weather we're having, the fall that is arriving soon? Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 with your weather questions. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff and your weather calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today on the line, we're joined by meteorologist Jason Goff. He is here to answer your weather questions. Jason's forecasts have been broadcast in this region for years. He now runs a great forecasting website at jasonsweather.com. If you have a question for Jason Goff, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, our number is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing good, Ray. Good to talk to you. What's going on a Wednesday afternoon?
Not much. I heard somewhere, I think it was in our weather summary this afternoon during Midday Magazine, I was filling in, and I think the average temperature around here is 75 at this time of year. Is that right?
Yep, it is. You know, September in any given year is our best month. I would have people email me from, you know, out of town or whatever the case may be that were planning a wedding. And they said, you know, what is the best month? Obviously, you know, however far in advance you would plan a wedding, 16 or so months. And I always tell people September, it's your best opportunity for, you know, nice warm days, but the humidity is generally, although today is a bad example of that, but the humidity is generally pretty tame and the temperatures aren't too hot. You know, you have some anomalies here and there. Obviously we do get a little rain, but by and large, overall, it's a pretty solid consensus that September is our best month of weather.
You know, it's funny. We often talk, a recurrent theme on our shows is the power of perception and sort of how you think things are. And my immediate perception of September is, oh, it's much chillier than that. So I was surprised to hear 75 degrees is the average temperature for this date.
Yeah, you know, it starts to slowly fall off once you get into the latter part of July. Temperatures slowly start to fall off a little bit, but it, you know, it is a slow process. Eventually we bottom out at 30.
Really?
In the middle of January. So yeah, for an average low or average high low, that is. So yeah, so it's a slow descent. And then of course a slow climb back up. What goes up must come down in the world of weather.
All right. This email came in and then we'll perhaps take a break and then jump to the phones. This is from Rob. And I know you've discussed this before. Jason, what's your opinion of the Weather Channel naming winter storms? The National Weather Service doesn't do this. They only name hurricanes and tropical storms. To me, it seems that what the Weather Channel does in the winter is cheap and cheesy, and that's from our buddy Rob.
Yes, cheap and cheesy is good, and I'm able to say that, so that way you don't have to worry about using your dump button there in front of you, Ray.
Thank you.
Yeah, it is deplorable. I hate it.
Well, why do you hate it so much? It's showbiz.
Because that's the problem, is that to me, you know, I'm a purist when it comes to this stuff, and weather needs no hyping. Weather is self-hyping, so you don't need to get into all of this. And essentially what you're doing is you're using weather for ratings, and I understand it's a business, blah blah blah, but at the end of the day, man, you can still get your point across without having to sensationalize it. And I've heard, you know, boots on the ground, you know, you talk to people, they know what they want. People are intelligent and they don't want this. They don't want this hypey stuff. And it's just like, you know, it's enough. You know what I'm saying? Like, it drives me crazy. So, yes, cheap and cheesy, let's stick with that.
All right. Now, just to be clear, from our legal department, that was what our listener wrote in. That was not what I said. My opinions, of course, are not germane to this discussion in any way. Now, there's a named storm down in the Mediterranean, or not the Mediterranean, the Caribbean right now, right? And that's Renee?
We have two storms, not quite into the Caribbean yet. You've got Paulette and Renee. They're lined up. By the way, the earliest P and R names in the Atlantic Hurricane Seasons archives. So it's, I can't remember when the earliest R storm was, but I think it was around like September 17th. So we're getting a lot of storms, and that happened in 2005 when we actually had to jump into the Greek alphabet to continue the naming of storms because we ran out of names.
No, wait a minute. The naming of the storms, they run through the alphabet each season?
Yes. I mean, you know, you don't have like, there's not a Q, there's not a Z, and a few others. So I should look that up at some point in time. I think there's around 20 names that are separated out, you know, English, Spanish, and French. And then if you get beyond whatever that number is, again, I think it's around 20, then you've got to jump into the Greek alphabet. And that's only happened once, and that was 2005. And these are the storms that have broken 2005's record. So it's a really good bet that we're going to be into the Greek alphabet here before the end of this hurricane season. But long answer to a short question, Ray, we've got these two storms are basically smack in the middle of the Atlantic. Paulette is, Renee is a little bit farther to the east, and they are both forecast to only remain as tropical storms and to stay offshore. Bermuda might have to deal with Paulette a little bit, but not a huge deal at the moment. What we're really keeping an eye on is a tropical wave that is coming off of the African continent. And that thing might be open for business here about this time next week. We'll keep a sharp eye on that.
When is the official end of the hurricane season?
November 30th.
Wow.
So, and it peaks out of all days, for crying out loud, September 11th. So 2 days from now is the climatological peak of hurricane season. And then it actually falls off. If you look at a graph, there's a pretty steep climb from mid-August to mid-September. And then there's almost a steep decline on the back side of that. But the neat thing is, neat only in the weather meteorological sense, is that we get a little spike in October. And that's generally when we keep an eye in the Gulf of Mexico, the Bay of Campeche, down into the Caribbean. And, you know, when folks basically from about the Mississippi River east are most, you know, vulnerable to those types of storms. In 05, actually, it was Wilma. And that was a bad mamma jamma. That storm was nasty and rolled over it and did a lot of damage to South Florida. So we've got a lot to go yet. It reminds me of Al Pacino in Scent of a Woman when he says, "I'm just getting warmed up."
Now,
that's kind of what the season is doing.
Jason Goff, when is the official Sharknado season?
Oh, jeepers. That's a good question. Right. That I don't know. Right. I'm going to need some audience participation with that.
Audience precipitation. Yes, it's weather today with Jason Goff. 800-348-2551. We'll take a quick break. The email address is voxpopwamc.org. We'll be right back. Fox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. The number is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff is with us. His website is educational. It's fun and pretty entertaining. Jasonsweather.com. Hey, Jason, do you ever just wake up in the morning some days and say, geez, I wish I could put a tie on and go in front of a camera again?
I do. I miss that piece of it. I do. I always enjoyed being on the air and, you know, being able, I just love weather. So I love to talk about it. And I'm greatly appreciative of you guys giving me the opportunity to do that, especially in such a, you know, just a random forum. But I do. I miss being on the air, but I don't miss the television business itself. So it's just the way it goes.
You know, I love you describing this as a random forum. That is the most perfect description of this program I've ever heard. Brennan in Granby, Massachusetts. Brennan, you're first. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. I have always wanted to ask a modern meteorologist whether the Farmer's Almanac retains any value, and if so, what is it? What can they accurately do and what can't they?
Well, you know, that's a good question because it's really ingrained, especially in folks, you know, from age 40 on, I think. And there is a lot of value to the Farmer's Almanac. It's a wealth of information about all kinds of folklore and, you know, farmers are the backbone of this country back in, you know, I mean, they are now too, of course, but back in the day. And so, you know, nobody understands weather back then as farmers. But in terms of actually doing long-term forecasts, You know, it's just not something that you would really want to put any money on. You want to leave it to the professional meteorologist, if you will, and being able to use, you know, up-to-date computer simulations and things like that. And even those can kind of go haywire, even on a month-by-month basis, let alone a whole seasonal one. So I've seen some really bad forecasts from the Farmer's Almanac, and they do a pretty good job of trying to spin it. And I don't mean that in a negative way. Sometimes spin can have a real negative connotation. But so I dig the Farmer's Almanac, but I just would not rely on it in terms of being a, you know, a big time solid weather source by any stretch.
Hey, Brennan, you know, Jason's being extraordinarily diplomatic here. I've heard you, you know, on past shows, you say, well, I've done some studies of this, and you could go into more specifics if you want it, you know.
Yeah, I have. There is a, you don't want to call it a method in forecasting, but it is something that you can do, and it's called persistence.
Yeah.
And what persistence forecasting is basically saying today is going to be just like yesterday. And if you do that over the course of a year, your accuracy rate is going to be about 66%.
Oh.
And the, you know, which if you're just at home doing that, if you were on the air or really putting out professional forecasts, 66% would have you looking for a new job pretty quickly. But the Farmer's Almanac, I did a study on that and just grabbed a year and just looked at various things. And it was more like 1 out of 3 instead of 2 out of 3. It was about 32%.
Okay.
So it's just, you know,
yeah.
Again, it's more folklorish type stuff and talking about, you know, woolly bear caterpillars and squirrels gathering, you know, nuts and storing them. And I love that stuff, but it doesn't really have any practical relevance in terms of, you know, hey, I'm driving to New York City next week. Is it going to be a blinding snowstorm or not?
Right.
That doesn't really help you in that case.
But, you know, it's a lot of fun to read that. There's so much good stuff to read there. So let's be clear on that point on this random forum. Jason Goff joins us. Tom in Kingston. Tom.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Chris.
Hi.
Hello.
You're on, man.
How's it going?
Good.
Okay. Well, it's really simple, Mr. Goff. I happen to know that a gallon of water weighs 8.2 pounds. Now, when I look up at a nice, fluffy, cumulus cloud, just a standard, beautiful, fluffy cloud, I'm thinking, how much water is that?
Yeah.
I mean, how much is that? And how does it, I mean, if you could please speak to what that water content is and why it stays up there.
Yeah. And how heavy is a cloud? This is great. Go ahead.
Yeah. How heavy is a cloud? That's all.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
It is great. And Ray was very gracious with his description of my website. And if you go to jasonsweather.com and you hit up a section called Droppin' Knowledge, I actually wrote an article about that. Let me ask you this. Before I answer your question, give me a guess. What do you think?
40
the
pounds.
Average cumulus cloud. How much?
42 well, pounds.
No, it's got to be a lot more than that.
All right, I'm kidding.
Okay. Well, that was, I'm sorry. You guys, the Graf and Goff show, you should take it on the road. I don't know, several tons? Depends on how big
close.
It is, I guess.
It is about, so just on average, you want to talk about just a little over 1 million pounds.
Wow.
So what you're doing
and
is
it,
you're,
and it stays
and I'm just,
up there.
And it stays up there.
It does stay up there. Water is lighter than air, water vapor, that is. And as things continue to develop in these clouds and stuff like that, their buoyancy, that is the air, is keeping these droplets going. And so I used to do this when I would go in to visit schools, go into classes and stuff, especially like the third and fourth graders. And we talk about the water cycle and all that. And the really straightforward analogy is if you have a dry sponge, right, and you put a little bit of water in it, well, that sponge is wet, but it's not dripping out any water from it. But if you continue to put water into the sponge, eventually you're going to saturate it and that water is going to come out.
Yeah.
So that's essentially what happens in these clouds. So you have that parcel of air that is warm enough to keep the water vapor in it. And then, of course, what you're seeing is the clouds is not actually water vapor. It's liquid and frozen water. Water vapor is colorless. But that's what you're seeing up there. So when you just basically do the math and it's just a function of density and and you're just estimating things. But yeah, you can generally say around 1 million pounds. So if you're hopefully wow. trivia gets back before too long in area watering holes, and if you ever get that question, now you'll hopefully win a prize.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Jason Goff is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. Speaking of clouds, my wife and I were out back looking at the sky. This was pre-thunderstorm. Well, there were thunderstorms in the region sometime last week, but they really missed the Albany area, but there were some bad ones around. And we looked at one of these thunderheads. What is the average altitude for the top of one of those suckers?
Well, that's a good question, Ray. The answer is generally in this area, we'll get them up to around 45, maybe 50,000 feet, the tops. The higher the tops in the storm, the nastier those storms are going to be. So when you get some of these supercells out in the Midwest and in the plains, some of those guys are up 70,000+ feet.
Wow.
And that's how you come to get that really large hail. Because you have a really deep freezing layer way up there. And so, but yeah, if we get some humdingers around here, some pretty good storms, you're for us, you know, anything around 50,000 is stout anywhere. For us, that's about as stout as it gets.
Jason Goff is our guest here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Terry is in Gill. Terry, you're on.
Hey, gentlemen, how you guys doing today?
Good. How are you?
Hey,
all right.
So I'm a truck driver, and this topic came up several years ago, and I can't remember where I was at when you guys were talking earlier about the naming of storms.
Yeah.
And this is what I think I got from that, and maybe you can help me correct me if I'm wrong. Basically, you know, all storms now try to get a name. You know, the Weather Service Channel, they give a storm, even coming across the plain. You know, a snowstorm, all get names now. And when what I thought I took away from that was the fact that basically it boils down to insurance companies now. It's just a way for them to be able to file people to file different claims with their insurance and for them to be able to, you know, save money and get over on their people a little bit more.
Jason,
what do you think? That was the main reason why all these storms got named.
Well, I will tell you this, that the insurance industry, they've been figuring out how to not pay claims long before winter storms were named. So I wouldn't think that that's part of it. But when you're talking about, you know, winter storms being named, that is just a function of marketing. That's something that the Weather Channel does. To me, it's gimmicky. It's goofy. It's unnecessary and almost kind of insulting, I guess, to a true meteorologist. So, you know, named storms that we have in the Atlantic hurricane season, you know, are all storms like that. Those indeed are named so that people, the public, that is, can keep track of them, especially like now when we're getting into the heart of hurricane season, the peak. You know, you may have two or three named storms out there at any one time. And so you want people that are potentially in the path of those storms to know which one you're talking about. So that is the purpose of that. But the winter storms thing, that's just some goofy thing that some TV consultant came up with, and that's the end of the story.
Hey, Terry.
All righty. Well,
hey,
yes.
You drive all around the country?
I'm pretty much northeast, South Carolina to Maine.
Yeah. What's the worst weather you've ever had to work through? Where has it been?
My worst weather, to be honest with you, I got stranded on top of the George Washington Bridge in New York City for 11 hours on a snowstorm one night.
Ouch.
Oh.
That would not be
That'll
fun.
Do it.
That was about
yeah.
three.
Good thing they didn't well, charge it by the hour.
Years ago, I'll tell you what, it was me. And the bad thing about it was, is, you know, it locked up the roads, and what I felt really bad about was all the school buses full of children.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody. It wasn't just me. It was the entire region.
Yep.
So I had four or five cases of water in my truck. I was out handing out bottles of water to, you know, people and little children, you know, so they could at least have something to drink throughout the night.
Well, good for you, man. Well,
but
listen.
That's the worst one.
Hey, thanks for calling. We appreciate the call. Jason Goff is our guest. And we talk the weather on this program every so often. 800-348-2551, the number. We'll go to our buddy Mark in Salem. Mark, you're on.
Hi. You know, I we had a blowdown here. It was not a tornado. All the trees, it took a 36-inch diameter locust tree and blew it over and pulled it right out of the ground.
Yeah.
And broke a 12-inch pine tree down. And the cloud tops, based on the radar, were like at 40,000 feet. They were not particularly unusually high.
Nope.
And I'm wondering, well, I took a course from Bertie Vodiga, you know, Kurt's brother,
yeah.
And in graduate school, and I understand it, but I don't understand the storms that we've been getting in the last 18 months to 2 years are smaller storms, but they're more violent.
Okay.
The vis-a-vis the tornado that went through, I think, Stillwater and then out that way, which was showed a lot of shear. I don't quite understand why the lower clouds are producing this kind of weather. I mean, I could understand if they were 55,000 feet or something like that.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts on it?
We talked a little bit. Ray asked about that a little while ago in terms of the height of storms in this area. You don't necessarily need to have a, you know, like there's no threshold that says, okay, you can't get a tornado if your cloud height is below, you know, 48,000 feet. In fact, out in the Midwest, there are what are known as low top supercells, and they're difficult to see because especially if you head out to, say, Iowa, for example, or any of the states in that belt, as you head farther west, you start to get into those rolling hills and things, and they can be difficult to spot from a distance. But still just as powerful. So in an effort for a tornado to get going, you do, as you mentioned, have to have shear. And the shear is not necessarily, you know, going to be dictated by how high up a cloud top is.
Hmm.
So it's just every situation is different. I mean, generally, you know, the two tend to walk hand in hand. The stronger the storm, the better the opportunity for a tornado. But you can have incidents.
Does local topography play a role in that at all? I mean, if you have a mountain that is going to raise the cloud 1,000 feet, and does that have any effect on it? I mean, I think it would.
That doesn't necessarily have anything to do in terms of getting cloud tops. So, in other words, you know, if you were in, let's say, Averill Park as opposed to Rensselaer, right, over in Columbia County, there's a pretty decent elevational difference there. That's not going to make a difference, or even a farther distance than that. Where the topography comes in for our severe weather is actually the valleys, because that can help to funnel winds. And if you're getting winds that are coming in from opposite directions, then you're going to be talking about shear. In fact, after the Great Barrington tornado in 1995, the Storm Prediction Center, as well as UAlbany and the Weather Service, they did some studies on that, you have the Hudson River effect. And so as that storm crossed from the southern tier of New York, it came over the Catskills, and it was pretty nasty in its own right before it got to the Hudson. But then it got to the Hudson, and it was able to tap in to more of a southerly wind, and that helped to enhance the shear, which is why Eastern Columbia County and the Southern Berkshires were really hammered by one of the strongest tornadoes ever in the Northeast.
Mark, thanks
so
a lot.
So it's the topography of the valleys, not the mountains.
Meteorologist Jason Goff joins us on Vox Pop today. The number is 800-348-2551. And let's go to Gail in Oneonta. Hello there, Gail.
Hi. I was wondering, I have family in Laramie and I have family in L.A. County. And I've been getting pictures of forest fires and what it does and some clouds. And I understand that they cause their own weather.
Oh, interesting.
Forest fires?
Mm-hmm. They do. They do, yes.
All right.
They do. So if you wanted to create a cloud and then you wanted to create rain and then even a thunderstorm, what you need to do is you need to heat the air at the ground level. And that warmer air rises because it's less dense than colder air, and it's going to make its way up into the atmosphere. I mean, that's the essence of the water cycle. When you have a fire, obviously you're talking about an incredible amount of heat in a relatively small area. And so you can get lots of weather that is made from these. You can get lightning strikes out of these things. You've seen those from volcanoes too. But what can happen in forest fires is that you can actually get lightning that is created from a cloud and from a particular fire, and then you can get a lightning strike that can start another fire. So that's a bad thing, and that's called dry lightning. And dry lightning is the cause. I mean, in addition to knucklehead human beings, you also have a lot of forest fires that are just started naturally by what is known as dry lightning. And that is when you have a bolt that's coming from a farther distance, or you just happen to have a little bit of a shower, but there was enough of a discharge, a potential difference, that is, to create lightning, and you're going to be able to get some strikes out of that, which can start forest fires. So it can be, you know, a rather nasty little cycle.
Gail, thank you very much for the call. All right, Jason, on that topic, reading the AP Wire this morning when I was looking over the news, getting my 9 a.m. newscast together, they had a bit about the fact that over the Rockies tomorrow, and I guess today to some extent, temperatures are going to plunge, and that will lessen the possibility of fire. Now, I couldn't figure out exactly why a drop of temperature would affect fire.
Well, what they had, too, there was they had snow. I was looking at some of the snow reports this morning. They were up to a foot and a half in some spots. And so, but what happens when you're getting in that colder air, you're generally are getting drier air, you're getting clouds. So you're taking away heat. And then also the air can be relatively stable. Once your system that's bringing your snow and things come through, if you get into some more stable air, that's going to relax the wind. And that's the big thing, is that you want, you know, it's the winds that are really the nastiness. And that's another kind of a cycle, because fires create their own winds as well. So basically everything sort of quiets down, but it's not like the cold freezes the fire,
right?
But it slows things down. And just generally speaking, it just, the conditions become a lot less conducive for these things to continue to take off as they do.
Meteorologist Jason Goff joins us. We'll take a fast break here, and then we'll hit the home stretch. 800-348-2551. And we have a line or two open. We'll try to get to as many as we can. We'll be right back. National treasure for you, the great John Schofield and Combo 66 here on Vox Pop. It is 2:41. Jason Goff joins us today to talk the weather, and the number is 800-348-2551. All right, this email, Jason, I love these emails that come in with words I can't pronounce, and it happens often. This one is, now I've seen this on in the news, in print, but I've never had to say it. So here we go. This one is from Nan in Wilton. I'm originally from Iowa. They were hit with a peculiar type of storm called a derecho. None of the old folks back home were familiar with it. It just devastated a third of the state. Loss of crops and property damage. What is it and why is it? I didn't hear much about it. That's probably because no one knew how to say it, Nan. give us the inside scoop, Jason.
It's a derecho is what it's called. It's a Spanish word, and it is, and I cannot, now it just escaped my little pea brain, but it's a Spanish word, and it comes from something along the lines of strong wind. Obviously, the Spanish had a much more eloquent way of saying it,
right.
But that's what it's called. And if you go to the Storm Prediction Center's website, they have a really good write-up on derechos, how they form and what they do. But in essence, what they are is they are a really fast moving cluster of really nasty storms. And there are atmospheric conditions that allow them to fire up and move as they do. They are relatively rare, but certainly not unheard of. The one that did hit Iowa was horrific. Some of the pictures I saw from there are things that you would see from a tornado that is having 2x4s stuck into the sides of houses and things like that. But those were straight line winds. We've had a few in this area. There was one that hit here in 1995 that tore through the Adirondacks, took seven lives in the process, along with I believe it was over 1 million acres of trees.
Yep.
So, and just looking at the radar of that complex moving, and the thing is, again, they move really fast. So, you know, you see this thing coming down from the St. Lawrence Valley, crossing into Hamilton County, and, you know, you're not talking 70 miles like going up the Northway. You're talking as the crow flies or as the storm moves. So imagine a nasty, nasty cluster of storms being up in some place like, you know, Caroga Lake or, you know, somewhere up in the southern Adirondacks and being rolling right over the Capital District at less than an hour later.
Yeah.
They are nasty things. There was one back maybe around 10 years ago, if I remember right, because I was tracking this working on the air, and it ran through D.C. and Virginia and just tore up a bunch of stuff. People were without power for 2 weeks. It was brutal.
Now, how long will a storm like that last? What is the lifespan in hours or minutes or miles?
They can go 700 or so miles.
Wow.
I'm just throwing that out there. They can go a long, long distance. They can go over 1,000 miles, actually. So they can go that distance, and because they travel at the speed that they do, it's not like they're moving along and then they kind of slow down a little bit. They just keep on trucking. So, you know, if you go, 1,000 miles, let's say, you know, you're talking about 14 hours or whatever that turns out to be. So, they can last for a long time. So, you know, 8 to 15 hours, it just depends on how much juice they have, how much upper level support they have. But they are nasty, and they're difficult to forecast. The forecasters have a better idea now in terms of what to look for, but the situations always, you know, don't always pan out. And then sometimes you'll see them develop into a derecho, and that's when the forecasters go, all right, well, we got this going on now. And then everybody, what they call downstream of it, has to get ready for it.
Jason Goff is our guest today. Jason's website is jasonsweather.com, and let's go back to the phones. John in West Sand Lake. John, you're on.
Thank you. So, Jason, back in mid-July, I was driving down to Long Island from here in the Capital Region. And in Westchester and the Bronx, I encountered some very severe but brief thunderstorms. And by the time they blew away and I was in the Bronx approaching Long Island, and there was a slash in the sky that looked like it had been painted on my windshield. That part of the sky was totally medium blue, and the other part was a light blue, and as if it had just been, as I said, painted on my window. So I wondered if you had a sense of what that phenomenon was.
Well, you know, the fact that you said that it was a relatively small or an isolated storm is just that. So you can have these storms and they'll pull moisture from wherever they can get them from. And so what you're actually seeing is the difference in the moisture in the atmosphere, generally speaking. So just for a point of reference, when you go out on a September day, you know, when we get these bluebird skies, we have a morning in the upper 40s. And then the afternoon is in the low 70s and just those really blue skies. Dew points on those days are really low. So you don't have water vapor in the atmosphere that's scattering that light. And then as you get into a day like this, I mean, as I'm looking out the window now, it's a little bit of an overcast, but the sky is definitely a lighter blue looking to the north. And that's just a function of their, you know, it's humid out. And so the atmosphere is scattering that light a little bit more and giving it sort of a hazy look. So that's what you sort of saw just on a smaller scale.
Hello? Work for you, John?
Hey, is he there?
Yeah. Did you hear that?
All right.
All right, man. Thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. And Reed is in Glens Falls. Hello, Reed.
I have a question.
Yes?
That if can cyclones touch down on the water?
Can cyclones touch down on the water, Jason Goff?
Yes. So let's clarify some terminology. First of all, how old are you?
I am 7.
Yeah, good man.
You are 7. Good man. Well, thank you for calling in. So here's the deal. Any area of low pressure is, in weather terms, in meteorology, is termed a cyclone. So sometimes cyclones sound really big and mean and nasty, and there are in other parts of the world what we call hurricanes, they call cyclones. So that just wanted to sort that out.
Right.
So what I believe you're asking me is, can a tornado touch down over the water? And the answer to that is yes, and those are called waterspouts. Waterspouts are pretty common, even in the Great Lakes, but certainly down in the Gulf of Mexico, in the Bahamas and places like that. But any thunderstorm that's strong enough over water can spark a tornado, but as it over water, it's called a waterspout. If it comes on land, which usually doesn't happen, but sometimes it does, if it comes on land, then it's known as a tornado. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
All right.
Yeah, there was some terrifying footage years ago now. I think it was in Miami, and there was a water spout, and it rolled right through town, or was that my imagination?
No, you're spot on, Ray. In fact, I was thinking about that as I was talking to our little caller there. And yeah, that's fairly rare. It's rare for something like that to happen. What made that such a unique thing was that the water spout was really strong.
Yeah.
So it ended up being classified, if I remember right, I think it was an F2 tornado, which is, you know, that's not something really to mess around with. And the fact of the matter is it went right through Miami. And that was really something. To see the video of that was pretty scary stuff.
Yeah, it's great video. Jason Goff is our guest, and let's go to Don in Springfield, Mass. Don, you're on.
Hello there. I want to comment on the water spout. We had one in Springfield a few years ago.
Oh, yeah?
That went across the river. It started on one side, went across the river, and came up the other side.
Wow. Did you see it?
It was on somebody got it live on the tube, you know, on their camera.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
Cool.
But I was going to ask about the low temperatures in terms of the climate stuff, because, you know, I know you deal with 30-year averages. And my understanding is that the change was most likely in winters, and nights was when the biggest change was. And I'm thinking city people notice it the least, because when you're outside in the winter, you got your coat on, you're going someplace in a hurry, what's the difference between 20 and 25? It's cold. You got your coat and you're trying to go.
Yeah.
But it can make a big difference if you're farming and out in the countryside where I live.
Yeah.
Yes.
So can you speak about that at all? Yeah.
Go ahead, Jason.
Yeah. And yep. So what happens is every 10 years, I should say, the Weather Service updates its 30-year average. And so you had, 1970 to 2000, then you had 1980 to 2010, and now we're going to be doing 1990 to 2020. They'll assess all of that, and it'll be out, I would imagine, sometime early next year, once they've had a time to crunch all the numbers and stuff. And then they do comparisons, and you can look really the benchmark, if you will, from my friends at Climate Central, which is a great, and again, we don't generally talk a whole lot about climate change on this show, but if you go to climatecentral.org, it's a great site. It's got all kinds of stuff. And you're spot on. What we're noticing more is nighttime temperatures not getting as cold. Daytime highs are, they're coming up a degree or two, which doesn't sound like a lot, but in the grand scheme of things, it is. And yes, winters are becoming milder. You ask anybody that goes ice fishing, you ask any hardcore skiers, it's more than just anecdotal. Our snowfall has gone down a few inches by the decade here and there. And, for what it's worth, this year, it looks like we're going to have, it looks like it's going to be a La Nina year, which would put us at least in favor to have a less snowy winter. That's not always the case, but about 2 out of 3 winters it is.
Don, thank you for the call. All right, explain once again El Nino and La Nina.
So it all has to do with what's going on over the Pacific. And, what a lot of folks have trouble understanding is the interaction between the air and the water, especially when you're talking about, just thousands of miles of open water in the Pacific Ocean. So what happens is when you have winds that are blowing, they're westerly winds, they can get the water temperatures what they do what is called upwelling. So the winds can actually stir the water, so it brings the colder water up from underneath, and that is what is in a La Niña year. And so when you have weaker winds, you generally have that water does not get upwelled, and then the water is a little bit warmer in the Pacific. And it was fishermen that noticed this off the coast of the west coast of South America, and that's an El Nino year, and it happens around Christmas time, which is why it's called El Nino. So, and those have implications on all kinds of things. They have implications on our hurricane season. When you have a La Nina year, which we're coming into one now, you tend to have less wind shear in the atmosphere, and wind shear is an inhibitor for hurricanes.
Ah.
So if you have less, if you have less wind shear, then the opportunity at least is there for you to have stronger storms.
Hmm.
It also, for our part of the country, it tends to promote more of a southwesterly, what we call a southwesterly flow, which means that we're not tapping into that real cold air that we need, that thick layer of cold air that we need to get a decent snowstorm coming up the coast. Now, again, that's not set in stone. Our snowiest year on record in Albany, 1970-71, that winter, was a La Nina year.
Yeah.
Oh, it was brutal, right?
Snow up to the windows, the second floor windows, we had drifts going up. I remember it well.
Well, that was a heck of a year. But, you know, in any given year, so if you were a wagering man or woman and you wanted to place a bet on whether we're going to have above or below average snow a year, in a La Nina year, you would win 2 out of 3 times if you said below. So 66%.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Let's jump on the phones one time here. And Danielle in Albany. Danielle. Hello.
Hello to you both. I want to say, can you hear me?
Yeah. Can you turn your radio down just a wee bit?
Hello to you both. Can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead.
I can.
Hi. Oh. I think you're in a bad spot.
I'm with you on Channel 13 News. Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead. Now we can hear you. Go ahead, Danielle.
Okay. Hi to you both. I wanted to say, Jason, it's good to hear your voice. I miss you on Channel 13 News.
Well, thank you.
I remember my mom would always say during a thunderstorm, unplug everything. Is that still the case? Or is that just kind of like a thing moms would say?
All right, you're dropping in and out, but we got that. Should you unplug stuff during an electric storm? Okay.
That's a good question. It certainly is a good idea to do, yes, because, you know, and you would say to anybody, especially now with electronics being as expensive as they are, you know, if you have a desktop computer or a big, you know, TV, smart TV or whatever, you always would want to get a surge protector. Because, you can get that surge. And it's not so much an issue now with telephones because the landlines continue to go away. But even landlines, you know, the suggestion is to not be on the phone because, you know, electricity can travel through that wiring. And if it hits in just the right place, I mean, I remember working when I was in school at Auburn. I remember it was one of the scariest things. We had a nasty thunderstorm. I was working in a restaurant. I was waiting tables, but I was in the kitchen by the dish area, and lightning struck the back parking lot. Well, below that blacktop were the pipes that ran into the kitchen, and the dishwasher got knocked off of his feet.
Wow.
So you think about that, and he was okay. I mean, the ambulance came, they checked him out, but that was some scary stuff, man. And so you can definitely have things blown out if lightning hits, you know, where it's not supposed to. So, yes, I would say either unplug it or make sure that you have a good surge protector for your electronics. That's a really good thing to have.
Danielle, thanks a lot for the call. Jason, on your website, now I've been there several times, but I have not found an article, and maybe you have one, about those instances where fish fall from the sky. Have you ever looked into that?
I have not. I don't have an article on there about that, but I have heard, you know, stories. I mean, speaking of things like, you know, the Farmer's Almanac. But yes, that can happen where you can have fish that can get picked up from a tornado or something along those lines. You know, it sounds weird, and it's certainly a rare occurrence, but yeah, that can happen. For
All
sure.
right. Well, we're out of time here. We'll leave it on a surreal note. Hey, man, thanks a lot. Once again, the website is jasonsweather.com. We'll see you soon, all right?
I will look forward to that, Ray. We have to have an in-person Vox Pop. I'm looking forward to that.
We got the bottle standing by, my friend. We'll talk to you soon.
I'm ready. Thanks, sir.
You betcha. Support comes from the Albany Pine Bush Preserve, presenting 20 miles of trails for solitary nature walks and online resources for remote learning, albanypinebush.org. And Studio KTM Organic Hair Salon, Red Hook, taking reservations for private, one customer in the salon at a time appointments with cutter and colorist Kristen Marquette, studiokTM.com. Well, that's it for today. Once again, thanks to Jason Goff for being with us today. Thank you for the calls. My apologies if we didn't get to your call, and I know there were several, but hey, that's the way with the cookie crumbles, you know what I mean? Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered by Matthew Plummer. Our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we talk election law with Professor Alejandra Paulino of the Albany Law School. Stand by now for 51%.